speedrun. Well, now we've got to better move along. After all, we're in the first chapter of Helaman here, and we just come to Coriantumr's exploit, where he overruns Zarahemla. He marches right into Zarahemla, and the reason he could do it is because there was so much social unrest in Zarahemla. This Coriantumr was the leader, and he was appointed leader by Amoran, who was the brother of that rascal Malachiah. And Amoran and Malachiah, and then so this fellow is a nephew of Amalekiah, and he's been put in charge of it. He's running things, a nephew of Malachiah, Amoran, but he puts Coriantumr in charge. And Coriantumr's, here's an interesting distinction. Notice in verse 15 here of this first chapter. He was led by a man whose name was Coriantumr. He was a descendant of Zarahemla. Means he wasn't a Nephite. And he was a descender from among the Nephites. So Nephites is a political term here, as it's been telling us a long time. He descended from the Nephites. That's the Nephite society. They all call themselves Nephites, you see. He descended from among the Nephites, you see. He was among the Nephites. He was a large and mighty man, but he was a descendant of Zarahemla, who was a Amulekite, of course, who founded Zarahemla. Therefore, the king of the Lamanites, and his name was Tubalot. It's very interesting because of the 26th dynasty at the time of the 22nd dynasty that preceded it, just before Lehi's time, the name Takalat, Tubalot were common names. Takalat was especially a name, but it follows that same structure. So it was a Nephite, was a political term here. And then he appointed Coriantumr leader for this enterprise. He marched smack down into Zarahemla, and the reason they were able to make such an easy break-in was like Singapore or like Pearl Harbor. Their guard was down. They didn't expect anything at all, but wham, it hit them like everything. Remember they said the Japs said, the British said the Japs could never come through the Malay Peninsula to Singapore. They'd always be safe. So their mighty guns, they had 16-inch guns, they couldn't be pointed in that direction. They thought they were safe from that direction. That's where the Japs came from, of course. But as the great General Savora says, Jejot Oyen Gijot Chilviek, Jejot Chilviek, Jejot Armye. Where a deer can go, a man can go, and where a man can go, an army can go. So don't expect there's any terrain that can't be negotiated by an army if a deer can do it. And that's what the Japanese did in the Malay Peninsula. They just came down. The British had their big guns, but they couldn't point them at the Japs. They were pointed out toward the sea. Well, but there was so much contention among them. They hadn't kept sufficient guard, it says, over them. And as I say, we all know about Pearl Harbor. We had all sorts of guards there, but it's the mental state. That's the all-important thing, you'll notice, and more than anything else. And they marched with great speed. It was a real blitz attack here, says in the 19th verse. And he cut down the watch, the whole army in the city. He took possession of the whole city. Zarahemla, right in the center of the land. Pachymene, the chief judge, had to flee. He was killed trying to get away. And Coriantumr then obtained possession of the strongest hold in all the land, which was the center. And then he went forth to expand his conquest toward the city of Bountiful and obtained the north parts of the land. That's where that was the strongest part, you know. And he was met by small bodies, which they cut down. They should have practiced guerrilla warfare, as we've learned since then. And he marched right through the center, and he got him right in the center. But Moronihai had put all the defenses on the outside. Of course, they never expected anything like that. So he was actually surrounded. Coriantumr had actually got himself surrounded, and he was taken care of. He marched through the land, the 27th verse, slaying people with a great slaughter, like the Nazi carnival going into Poland in September 38. And as Tyrtaeus and Calinus, the Greek poets, described how the barbarians marched. It's their ways to just go through and slaughter everything indiscriminately. It's a normal procedure for armies anyway. Moronihah had sent forth Lehi to stop him. Now, when he meets Lehi, that's too much, because Lehi is a very tough guy. And they began to fall back on Zarahemla, and Moronihah had them in their retreat, and there was an exceeding bloody battle, and Coriantumr was killed, and that's the center. Nobody had their hearts in this thing. Notice neither side was very worked up about it. They were both willing to call it quits then. The Lamanites did yield themselves into the hand of the Nephites. What did the Nephites do? They just let him go. That was all. Moronihah took Zarahemla again, caused that the Lamanites who had been taken prisoners should depart out of the land in peace. Notice, no reparations, no indemnities. Well, is that wise? Look what they've done. It was an army that raided their country, sacked their capital, killed people right and left, slaughtered everything, and yet they're let off, I say, without any reparations or indemnity or anything like that. Well, that was a wisdom, of course, because the Reparations and indemnities always lay the foundation for the last war. For the next war, excuse me. Remember World War I, when Clemenceau and Lloyd George insisted on making the Germans pay the last pound of flesh? Everybody had been guilty there. Woodrow Wilson was against it, but his plan was turned down both by the Senate and those countries, especially Clemenceau, and they really cracked down on the Germans and forced the situations that brought about World War II. Economic, that and the Smoot-Hawley tariff that wrecked German economy. On the other hand, after World War II, the reason we've had peace after World War II, in spite of the people always whipping up the Cold War and things like that, is the wisdom of two men, George Marshall and MacArthur, the Douglas MacArthur. The one gave us the put Europe back on its feet with the Marshall Plan instead of reparations, you see, in Germany immediately got back on its feet very quickly, and now it's the leading, that and Japan are the leading economic powers because of the wisdom of George Marshall and his plan. And the conqueror, the conquering hero, the Caesar, Douglas MacArthur, played the role of a very wise man. He could have done anything he wanted. He was the conqueror, as far as the Japs concerned. He was it. And what he did, he gave them their democratic government. He made it possible. Take a man like that. So you don't need to, there's no point to making vicious reparations. After all, I think bombing Nagasaki and Hiroshima was bad enough. But no, there were to be no, there was to be no punishment, and there were to be no reprisals against them at all. And that's the reason we've had a fairly sane world since then, for a while being, at least. So that's the way you do it, and it's very wise there. So then we go on now. Then what happens? The judgment seat, there begins. The troubles go on among the Nephites, though. Again, notice they fill the judgment seat. This judgment seat is most important. Well, who has more power than the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court today? Nobody does. As much power as anyone. They can make the law, the Supreme Court does. They make the final decisions. It rests with them. And so you get all this fuss about Carswell or Bjork, people like that. It's a very important office. The question is asked, now shouldn't that man be elected? He's someone who's appointed after, according to the whim of this person or that person, this interest or that person. He's appointed without having to run for office at all. Well, this happens to judges. And the power of judges is very great, as you know, and has led to a lot of questions recently. But Helaman was appointed to fill the judgment seat, and this Kishkumen, the hitman, were prepared to destroy Helaman too. And he was upheld by his band. Now we have organized crime, you see. His band, who had entered a covenant that no one should know their wickedness. See, we do not know what's behind, for example, Noriega. It goes way back, for example. But this organized crime, as we said before, if you were in business with a person who had no principles and knew he didn't, who would kill anybody for money, who would kill anybody and betray anybody and break any promise or do anything or shoot you in the back, how could you possibly do business with him and get along with him? Well, if men like that gang themselves together because they know in unity there is strength. Say the only way you can bind them is with these fearful oaths and covenants, terrible things they take. So you have the evil brotherhoods as well as the righteous brotherhood. There's two sides to brotherhood, just as there are two sides to Babylon. There's a good side, a culture side. Athens was a great Babylon for a while, but only very briefly, as in the Book of Mormon. And there are also two sides to the warlords, as a matter of fact. We just mentioned those. They can be the great conquerors, they can also be the great peacemakers. The greatest of the warlords was Alexander, and he did more for civilization perhaps than any other man did. And so they're good sides to the warlords, they're also good sides to the primitives, who can have their bad sides. I mean, they can be tribes governed by witch doctors and practice cannibalism. That's not a good side. On the other side, they can be the gentle savages that Columbus discovered and so forth. Were really gentle savages. There are such people. You know, the Pueblo Indians, the peaceful Indians, the Moki, the Hopi, and so forth. So here we go. There was one. Now here comes an expert. This Gadiant, now he was a pro. He was the new professional capo of the Gadiant, who was exceeding expert in many words. He's a fast talker. He could get, that's important. They always are, you notice. And also in his craft. Now this is his craft. He polished it. He was proud of it. He was efficient. He did a thorough job of bumping off. He would take a contract, and he was good at it, which was the secret work of murder, and he could crack a bank any time. He was good at murder and robbery, and we have experts in that today. He was professionals. He was the leader of the band of Kishkumen. He headed the band now. And he worked on them and said, look, if you'll put me in charge of the whole operation, I can take care of my boys. If they would place him in the judgment seat, that's all he wanted. He would grant those who belonged to his band, they should be placed in power and authority among the people. They'd have the high office. Well, this is just the feudal system. I mean, the big bandit and gets his supporters, those who support him most valiantly, he's the ring giver, as the opening lines of Beethoven and Beowulf tell us, going back the 8th century there, typical ancestors. That was good kinning, how it started out. Well, in Vedega, in the days of woe, should be placed in power and authority among them. So that's the way we take care of our boys. We do that in corporations and so forth. And here's one of the servants of Helaman. Now, he'd been out by night, and having obtained through disguise a knowledge of the plans, what was his disguise? His disguise was that of a defector, of course. He'd come over as an insider who knew all about it, and defectors are quite common. He was a mole, but he was actually an undercover man. He was a double agent for Helaman. He knew all the workings, and this is why they come to him, and why Gadianton says, lead me to him. Get me an audience with the judge, you see, so I can bump him off. So, this one of the servants of Helaman, because otherwise this looks rather confusing, but it isn't when you realize the nature of his disguise. He didn't wear a mask or a false mustache or anything like that, but his disguise was his persona. He was a defector. He'd come over. He knew all about Helaman, you see. So this is it. And he had attained a knowledge of the plans of those which had been laid to destroy Helaman. See, this is a regular police practice. He was put in there as an undercover man, or, as I say, a double agent. Came to pass, he met Kuskumen in the street, about his business, probably waiting for him, and he gave him a sign. Kuskumen knew who he was then, decided he could trust him, and asked him to conduct him to the judgment seat. He knew where the judgment seat was, but you see, this would be what you would ask of an insider, of a defector, someone who knew about it. You get him into the presence of the judge without being suspect. Conduct him to the judgment seat, because as a foreign stranger, well, as the notorious Gadianton, he wasn't notorious yet, he'd run a risk, but not with this man, to take him there. So that's why he's very pleased. The servant of Helaman had known all the heart of Kuskumen. He'd found all about it. He's a plant. And how it was his object to murder, and also it was his object, those who belonged to his band, to murder and rob and gain power. This was the secret plan. So it pleased Kuskumen exceedingly. He's got an in to the judge now, and he knows what he's going to do. It's a big double cross. He did suppose that he should accomplish his design. Behold, the servant of Helaman, as they were on the way, he says, hey, look here, bang, bang, bang. He let him have it. I mean, this is a typical episode from any evening of TV. If you want to edify yourself, you'll find this happening. Notice the double crosses dominates the scene now, makes things more exciting. We've used up all the other good guy, bad guy toys. Then notice, he said, the servant of Helaman said unto Kuskumen, let us go into the judgment seat. And it did. How did he know it pleased Kuskumen? How do we know it pleased Kuskumen if Kuskumen was bumped off on the spot, you see, as they were going? Well, the servant reported. Of course, we get all this information from the well-informed servant of Helaman. He told us the story. And so the servant of Helaman stabbed Kuskumen, and it came to pass that Helaman sent forth and came back and reported, of course, and Helaman makes no time. They're going to raid the headquarters. They're going to do a bust, but they're too late. They've already flown. This happens too, you see. Sent forth to take his band of robbers. Behold, when Gadianton had found that Kuskumen didn't return, very shrewd, very suspicious, and immediately said, we got to get out of here. There's something wrong. So his band followed him in flight out of the land. They wasted no time at all, so the bust was a bust. By the secret way into the wilderness, and when Helaman sent forth for them, they could nowhere be found. So that was that. But now, he says, I'm going to tell you this 13th verse, very important. We shall see that this Gadianton band did prove the overthrow. It proved the overthrow and almost the destruction, just as World War II proved the overthrow of the German government, the Nazi regime. It was the overthrow and almost the destruction of the people here. It almost destroyed the nation. It was its overthrow and almost its, they're not the same thing, you see. But the Gadianton band did overthrow the government, and did almost destroy everything, too, while they were at it, but not quite, you see. Almost the destruction of the people. Well, I didn't mean the book of Helaman, I mean the next book, he says. So, now we go on to happier times, or do we? We start out The next year, the 40 and 30 was a nice time. There was a little pride in the church, some little dissension, but they were taken care of, first, third chapter. No contentions in the 44th year. Not much contention. Much contention in the 40, but now it starts heating up. Much contention in the 45th year. And 4 months, 4 years after, all hell broke loose. Now, how should that be so soon? Why would they change so quickly? We see these things happen. In the 40 and 6th year, there was much contention, many dissensions, which there were an exceeding, they couldn't stand prosperity very long, could they? An exceeding great many who departed out of the land of Zarahemla. Now, this is this movement north, and it's a regular one. There were good people in it, too. It says here that the people of Ammon, the Ammonites, did it. Maybe it was to, in the 12th verse ahead, maybe it was to escape the general unrest, where it says that many of the people of Ammon, who were Lamanites by birth, did also go forth to this land. So to them, it was a general pioneering movements, what it was. They're opening up new lands in a time of prosperity. Excuse me, in a time of troubles here, of political stress and rivalry and all sorts of things like that, as they start this big movement toward the north here. And, yes, they just spread forth to all parts of the land. Now, here we get some geography. We try to avoid it, but there must be some here. A little later, we're told on that a certain place here was a day's journey by a Nephite from one sea to the other, so it was still in a pretty narrow neck. Exceeding great distance, that's a long way, to large bodies of water and many rivers. Well, is that the Mississippi Valley? Is that the Great Lakes? Is that central Mexico, which was full, as you know, of the Great Lakes at that time? Mexico City was built on a swamp, on lakes. And they spread forth into all parts of the land, into whatever parts. Now we get a very interesting thing. This next section, read here to verse 12. It's the ecology and environment. See, it's only within the last 10 years or so, just very recently, that people have been taking that seriously. Now we realize it's one of the great threats. And in 1830, when America was covered with woods and everything else, they were regarded nothing but something to be cleared away. But who ever got interested in ecology and environment? Well, this is a wonderful passage on that. This whole story here brings it all out, the importance of it. Up until very recently, well, in most cases still, ecology and environment were dirty words in Utah. I mean, people, they were against business, you see. They slowed it down. They were expensive, and they set natural resources aside, which could not be immediately exploited. So it's been taught just recently, 5-6 years ago, that anyone who mentioned those things in the state of Utah was sick. You were interfering with business. But now, things are different, aren't they? All of a sudden, we realize, and they realize that all of this is what happened here. And it's very valuable, this third chapter, for other things, too. It shows us that there had been other people in the land, not Jaredites, these aren't, that had been inhabited before. You don't have to say every time you discover a ruin or an artifact, you say, well, that's Nephite or Lamanite. Well, that's absurd. The moment doesn't require that at all. It just says more people can come after. More people came before. This is an example here. So then, they did spread into all parts of the land. Well, I want to show you here. I have some small map and a large one. You see the general idea. The thing we get here is, which is it? Is it east, west, or north, south? I have a bigger map here. Notice it goes more east and west than north and south. So you have seas north and seas south. And see, it talks about the sea north and south and the sea east and west from the same vantage point, they could move toward the sea north, south, east, and west. And that's so. There are places here where that can be done. We think of the Central America as running north and south. It doesn't at all. It runs east and west mostly, as you see there. Now, I have a big map. There's nothing to stick it on here. But it's a pretty good one. It's a National Geographic map here. And it shows what the layout is on a larger scale. And again, you can see here. If you look here, see, here is... It comes down here, and it's all... And here again, see, here's the Panama Canal. It enters from the Pacific side. It enters in the... It goes from east to west. The... Wait a minute. Yeah, this is the east. It enters the Caribbean, and it runs from... Not east to west. Yes. It enters the Pacific east of where it enters. It enters the Pacific. Yeah, it is, because I'm all confused. This is east and west. Here are the lines of longitude here, you see. And sure enough, this definitely, Panama City of the Pacific, is definitely east of Colon on the west. Yeah, Cologne is on the west. Could be very confusing. Can't it? And so the Book of Mormon keeps telling us about seas on the east and the west and the north and the south. And I say there's no point to getting all tangled up in this at all. But you get the general. And here is a land of many waters, you see, Nicaragua, and many rivers, too. Nicaragua, in fact, the clutch on Nicaragua wasn't the United Fruit. It was we were going to build a canal all through the 20s and 30s. As late as the 40s, the big plan was to get rid of the Panama Canal, which was too dangerous, too exposed, and build a real canal right through Nicaragua, where it would have been easier. It's water all the way, so you can go from the Indio River right over to this huge lake, Nicaragua, and out that way. It actually would have been easier, they said, in Nicaragua. Well, but anyway, the... It's up here. Oh, where? Then you get to the Valley of Mexico. I have another map there, and that's all water. But there are places... But how far is exceedingly far, I'd like to know? Oh, here's an interesting thing here, another thing I was going to read from, and it's rather important, too, to realize this, that, I didn't leave it on at home, did I? I always do things like that. I was so sure to bring that thing, that was, oh, no, here, just right here, in front of me. And it has a map in it. It's written by a Mexican anthropologist and archaeologist. No, he's Peruvian, isn't he? And here it shows a picture of North and South America, and he shows the distance from one end of the Inca Empire to the other end up here to be exactly the same as to be farther than from the entrance of the isthmus to New York City, you see. So they could... And the point he makes here is that this Inca Empire is through the rugged Andes and so forth, yet they had roads the whole length of it, and they moved back and forth on a daily basis. They had a milk run from one end to the other, which is greater than the distance from here to New York, or from Mexico City to New York. You could go right through. And much more rugged, this could be much more quickly negotiated than this, which is, as I said, was done quite often. So is Camorra too far? Is Camorra a bridge too far? I don't think it is. Not the way Indians move around. Well, anyway, we're not going to argue about those things. You can argue about that till the cows come home. And so they went a great distance. But this is the point here. Into whatever parts it had not been rendered desolate and without timber because of the many inhabitants who had before inherited the land. Now we learn about we get to the history of the Book of Ether, as we do. The others, they were nomads, wandering graziers, and they were very mobile in the manner of the Asiatics and so forth. And they were in this north country, as it said, who were disappeared, destroyed upon this north country. It starts out. They're in the north areas, and are different people entirely. It's a different culture. But these people were obviously practicing what the Mayans still practice, the age-old slash and burn. And they've cut it all out. What you do, remember, you cut down the jungles, and then the ash pot deposits makes the soil rich for a few years. But then it wears out. And as you know, jungle soil is very poor soil, so you have to move on. What you do is cut some more jungle. And then the ash and so forth, and that a while. So you keep progressively, with slash and burn, you keep progressively destroying the forest. That's what's worrying people today, of course. Except now it's being done for the cattle raisers, the cattle barons, as far as that goes. This is done systematically, not only there, but in other countries as well, but especially there. Now, no part of the land was desolate, save it were for timber. They didn't have that. But because of the greatness of the destruction of the people who had been before inhabited the land, it was called desolate. So they called that land, there had been people there before, but there's not a trace of them left. And we know that lots of Jaredites escaped and went back into the woods and were crawling around. People with Jaredite names turn up and intermarry with the Lamanites, a lot of that. But here, the land was called desolate. It was absolutely cleaned of forest. All you see in a vast area of Oregon now, which was beautiful just after World War I, is stumps, as far as you can see. And that'll never grow back again. You don't realize that Provo Canyon was densely forested until a great forest fire in 1915. It never came back again. Well, and there was but little timber on the face of the land. Nevertheless, the people who went forth became exceedingly expert in the work of cement. And this is a thing that made quite an issue about the Book of Mormon. Did build houses of cement in which they dwelt. I once thought the cement, well, cement is could be any bonded building. I mean, you use rocks with lime or stone between them, or with adobe or something between them. But this is, it's real cement in the National Geographic for August 1980. There's something about that. This is what it says. It's talking about this. Well, let me read you this section here. It's not. This is something, a talk I gave earlier down in Merida, in Yucatan. But read something called, there's S.J.S. Wilkinson is writing. He says, in the use of poured concrete system, my engineer colleague David Hyman at, say, Elta Haynes builders excelled in the techniques remarkably similar to today's of poured concrete. It wasn't just building with bonded masonry. It was pouring concrete. It was real cement houses. Concrete, just as we talk about cement, which came as a surprise to me. I didn't know they'd have it that much. Let me see. It says here, many Latter-day Saints are disturbed when they read of the remains that must be much older than Book of Mormon times. In their simplistic reading of the Book of Mormon, they assume that the only people permitted in the hemisphere before Columbus were either descendants of Lehi or Jared and his brother. The Book of Mormon corrects this quite handily here. We learn here in this passage, you haven't finished it yet, how the Nephites, pushing up from the south an exceeding great distance, it's more than 1,200 air miles from Guatemala to Mexico City, you know. They don't have to go into North America, into the Ohio Valley, to go an exceeding great distance. Say, air miles, 1,200 miles from Guatemala to Mexico City. In a major infiltration, they settled a clearly defined territory. There was a siege, it tells us here, that it was a siege to the north and to the south, as well as to the east and the west. Of course, that can only be found in one region. That's this Central American one we were just pointing to here. And the expression referring to the sea, to the seas were ancient. And in the Codex Ramirez, which was published in 1944, we are told how the first Montezuma conquered almost from sea to sea and ruled from the sea southward and in another direction to the limits of the Great Sea. So they thought of it as a sea southward rather than the sea west there. So it is in this territory here. The Great Montezuma, this is the way it puts it. Montezuma ruled almost from sea to sea. That would be higher up. He ruled to the sea southward and in another direction the limits of the Great Sea, 300 leagues to the south. The central highland of Mexico is described in all early records as a land of many waters. Indeed, Edward Sellaire, throughout the great, in his fourth volume, maintains that the name usually translated as highlands, Anahuac, really meant land of many waters. The complete deforestation of the land doesn't suit the vast forests of the north. They wouldn't completely lay them bare, but with a very serious problem in ancient Mesoamerica, because I say of your slash and burn economy. So we can compare this passage in from 5 to verse 10 here with the condition in the Valley of Oaxaca in the 5th to the 9th centuries B.C. So we're going back 1,500 years there, you see, from the 5th century to the 9th century B.C. When overpopulation, we're quoting here, created a growing shortage of timber for construction and firewood for cooking, apparently reaching such alarming extent that the hills were completely stripped of forest. That's a recent survey. So way back almost 1,500 years ago, they were doing the same thing. And Oaxaca, which is one of the most lush and beautiful places right between there down on the Tehuantepec Peninsula, they didn't have not just only enough for building, but they didn't have enough for firewood, enough scraps to go out and gather wood. Firewood for cooking, that's an alarming extent. Completely barren. That's exactly what it tells us here. The land was barren. And it tells us that they were alarmed and took drastic measures here. It says, they came to multiply and spread and go forth from the land. Notice, they go forth to the land southward and the land northward. You can go in both directions here. And they did spread so much that they began to cover the face of the whole earth, even from the sea south to the sea north and from the sea east to the sea west to the sea east. See, the 8th verse shows us we're in an area where there's seas in all directions here, the way you take it. And this shows you, I say, this is a lesson in ecology. So how strict they were, there's to be no cutting of trees, any trees at all. The people who were in the land northward did dwell in the tents and the houses of cement, and they did suffer whatsoever tree should spring up upon the face of the land, that it should grow up. They wouldn't let you touch a tree, a growing tree, that in time they might have timber to build their houses, yea, their cities and their temples and so forth. So until the tree grew up, all cutting was forbidden. So you're not going to get firewood out of that, are you? What are they going to burn, coal? And it came to pass as timber was exceeding scarce, it keeps harping on that, in the land northward, what they did, they was ship timber. Well, now, if you go back to the earliest records of Egypt, the Old Kingdom, to the time of Seti, to the time Pepi the Second, he left, well, we have lots of inscriptions, and then the great account from the year 1085, the story of Wenamun, who was an agent of Pharaoh, one of the pharaohs in the north there. He was sent up to buy timber for Egyptian buildings, and that's, of course, Egypt is not rich in timber, to say the least, as you know. So they would bring it from the Lebanon, and it is described in those texts way back before 2000 BC, and then the other was 1085 BC, because he gives us he had letters of credit, how he's to buy them, the trouble he had in the business, at times he was robbed and so forth. And then he describes how the oxen pull the great logs down from the Lebanon, how they're lined up and classified on the beach, all ready to be taken to Egypt, and they're pulled by special ships. And this was going back 4,000 years before Christ, they were doing this. The earliest tombs have these cedar of Lebanon in them. And at the same time, we know from other records from Babylonia on the other side of the mountains, Lebanon, where there were streams there. There were no streams on this side. You pull them down. It's very abrupt, as you know. You can see the pictures from there. Hills really pile up very, very high. They're terraced, very steep terraces all over Lebanon. But on the other side, there were streams. They would only work, of course, when there was heavy snows and in the springtime, during the spring floods. Then they would make rafts and float them down the river to the Euphrates, and they'd go right down to furnish the Babylonian civilization with their timber. The result is today, you see the flag of Lebanon is red, white, and green with a green cedar tree, a cedar of Lebanon in the middle. But you can find about half a dozen cedars of Lebanon today in a few little pockets where they've been preserved or replanted. You'll find a cedar. Here, they've sprung up, but just there must be 100 or 2 in the land. I mean, that's about all there are. You can't find cedars of Lebanon. They've been bare ever since. But one time that supplied the world with all the timber it needed for thousands of years. Plato describes the same thing as happening in the Peloponnese and how barren. So ecology is more important than you think. Once those forests go, they don't come back. The French made a very extensive study of the Sahara Desert after World War II, in which they concluded that it had been a mimosa plain as late as the Middle Kingdom of Egypt, and full of lakes, sparkling streams and lakes and so forth, and now it's a man-made desert. The Sahara? That's amazing. The deserts do spread. We're living in a day of spreading deserts. As you know, you can stand on the cliffs on the left bank of the Rhine, of the Nile, and watch those huge dunes, the way they're moving, swallowing up what little farmland is left now while the population increases. These are serious problems. And isn't this something here? Way back in the 1820s in upstate New York, which is all wooded country, where the woods were, you had to clear the woods by breaking your back, as Joseph Smith family did, to get enough land to cultivate, that you should say that the destruction of timber can be alarming, can be serious, can damage a civilization, and should be very strictly dealt with as far as that goes. And here we get it in the Book of Mormon. So it keeps us up to date here. And so they did enable the people, and thus by transporting timber, it was a big business transporting. I say in the ancient world, it was a big business. It went by sea, the Mediterranean. The main business was cedar of Lebanon for many years in the east end of the Mediterranean. And thus the landlord and the many people of Ammon, they joined it too, so it was a peaceful migration, and many records were kept of this proceeding. Now here's another interesting, many records, very large, we can't give 1/100th part of them here. It tells about, now here's a list of themes and subjects that you might write on. Take your choice here, notice. Well, there's counts of wars, we've been talking too much about them, and contentions. This is another theme he's talking about now, social troubles and dissensions, and their preachings and their prophesyings and their shipping and their building of ships and their building of temples and synagogues and their sanctuaries and their righteousness and their wickedness and their murders and their robbings and their plunderings and all manner of abomination and whoredoms cannot be contained in this work. Well, what about these vast libraries? Are you going to find any? I remember when I was teaching at Claremont, there was a girls' humanity class at Scripps College there, see. I taught it on Tuesdays, and Professor Goodspeed, who had retired from the University of Chicago, he was the big New Testament man in those times. He taught it on the other. We taught it twice a week. I took one day, and he took the other day. And the girls used to say, but look, Professor Goodspeed said there was no Hebrew written in the time of Christ. Nobody wrote Hebrew. There's not a scrap of Hebrew, of colloquial Hebrew, anything like that written from the time of Christ, and there wasn't at that time. But then along came 1948, and all of a sudden they started finding the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now we found thousands and thousands of documents and letters, all written in cursive Hebrew by the Jews. To that time, it was entirely unknown. And then this is the way these records are always discovered in an explosion, when you get almost too many. Now, for example, ancient studies began with the discovery in Nippur in 1850s by Stephen Langton, of the great library of Assurbanipal. It was a tremendous library. They didn't discover just a record here and there. You discover a whole library. And then the same thing happened. And then a little later, in 1887, they discovered the Amarna library, a tremendous amount of letters, correspondence between Egypt and the princes of Palestine, up to the time the Hebrews took over there. And the Hebrews are in it and everything else. All these hundreds and hundreds of letters, 800 letters. The whole thing... It was too good to be true. When these letters, they started shipping these letters, they're on tablets, and they're written in cuneiform, of all things, yet they're in Egypt. And when they started arriving in Paris, they started destroying them. They said, these are fakes, they're no good at all. Then suddenly they did a double take and realized they were genuine, and what a difference this made. And so you have the Amarna letters, and then you have in the 1930s, all of a sudden, at Ugarit, in a totally new language, North Semitic language, the libraries of Ugarit, which was a very rich city on the coast, occupied by Phoenicians, people related to the Greeks, but they wrote in the, they spoke the little Canaanitish language, it's written in Canaanitish and so forth. So in Lehi's time, there are all sorts of Greeks there and so forth. But this was earlier, see, the letters of Agar from 1300 BC. And the Amarna letters is a huge library. Then all of a sudden, remember, just after Professor Goodspeed died, all of a sudden they discovered Qumran and the great texts there, say thousands of documents and so forth. And then at the same time, they discovered, nobody paid any attention to Coptic, but now if you're going to study for the ministry, it's as important as Greek. Why? Because at the same time they discovered the library at Qumran, they discovered the Nag Hammadi library, which is all in Coptic, the earliest Christian text known. Again, a huge library. We have shelves from here. And so it goes. And then finally in the 1970s, near Aleppo, the Italians were finishing a dig. The last day, they were closing out for the season and so forth, and somebody unearthed the corner of a tablet there, and was curious. Of course, the written tablet's the first one they'd found. They got excited, and made further diggings. It was a room in which there were 15,000 tablets stored. So you find these records all at once. You find them at a particular time, late. They most come out late. I wouldn't be at all surprised. Their records are stowed somewhere, and sometimes they'll turn up. Well, after all, Father Delanda burned thousands of them. That may have been the big library that he destroyed, you see. And then he did the same thing as the buyers of the Sibylline documents, the Roman Sibylline documents. See, the seven Sibylline texts in the Roman Senate was going to buy them for a high price. The Sibyl asked too high a price. It had nothing doing. So she destroyed one temple and doubled the price. They wouldn't take it. He destroyed another and did double that price. Well, increasing exponentially, you can imagine the fabulous price she asked for the last tablet, and they were only too glad to get it then. So this is the way it went. And it's the same thing here, that the Nag Hammadi texts and the Qumran, but these others, we paid no attention to them, and they come out all of a sudden. And Father Delanda did a double take too, you see. He bitterly regretted what he had done when it was too late. See, don't lock the door. So we be careful about these things, the preservation and so forth. So the records are there. There's a big ball of wax here, and here's the subject. Many books, there's many records, chiefly kept by the Nephites, but not only by them, you see. Chiefly kept by the Nephites, it says in the fifth verse here. Where are we going to find them? They've been handed down from generation to generation, and the people are scattered on the face of the earth and mixed with the Lamanites. The Lamanites are mixed with the Lemites, so don't call it a pure Lamanite by any means. The 16th verse here. And the Nephites had become more wicked and wild and ferocious than the Lamanites. Now here he has a switch. This is another story now. And you notice, we're told that the righteous people, they become a dark and loathsome people and so forth. There's no mention of skin change here or anything like that. That doesn't necessarily accompany the thing at all. We won't go into that. That's another story. We'll take that the other semester, the first semester. But here, then, there's still great contention in the land. And, well, how can they carry on this contention year after year? Well, the Book of Mormon came out in 1830. And up until then, the country had been rather quiet. And then, as you remember, what happened at Charleston in 1832. And then all through the 1830s, the 1840s, the 1850s, nothing but ferocious, vicious contention. The country that led up to that terrible civil war, the worst civil war we know about. And all through those years, the 30s, 40s, and that terrible contention never stopped over the issue of slavery, of course, in the new territories and the like. So it's not impossible that they could carry on for 6 years here and being nasty to each other. And then came Helaman. He filled the judgment seat with justice, and he handed over to his two sons, Nephi and Lehi. Then there's a let-up in the 23rd. Things get better then, all of a sudden. But at the same time, in the 23rd verse, the mob is moving in. They're doing it very subtly. They're not advertising themselves. Continual peace established in the land, save it with a secret combination which the Gadianton robbers had established in the more settled parts of the land, of course, in the urban districts, of course, that's the way they do it. But it certainly caught the government off guard. It was not known unto those who were heads of the government. See, they moved in very subtly. They'd learned they had to run for their lives before. They cleared out. Now they're going to be very shrewd about it, as they do today, of course. All this infiltration has been going on for years. It comes the drug. They're not just the drug, but the others and so forth. They're known to the head of the government, the capos of the mafia. Known to the head of the government, therefore they were not destroyed. Nobody knew they were there. And the church enjoys great prosperity. It's absolutely amazed at what's happening to the church. This is the 49th year, you see. And blessings were poured out on the people. The high priest, the teachers themselves, were astonished beyond measure at this great progress. You're astonished at the progress of the church today. There's no real reason for it that you can explain, except that it's the work of the Lord. I mean, happening in the strangest places where you'd never suspect it. Very strange places. And baptizing people over the tens of thousands. They never expected that. Thus we see, now this is a very interesting thing here, the 27th. We've been talking about people who couldn't get along together. There was constant trouble and so forth. But who's to blame and what are we to do about it? Human nature is human nature. You get a kennel full of dogs and you don't pen them up or anything. You just let them loose and what happens? One dog will bound to start making trouble. They're dominant and submissive among all animals and someone's going to fight back. There's going to be trouble and the whole thing, and then there'll be pandemonium in the kennel as long as the master isn't there. But if there's a kennel master's there, everything will be all right. But God's left them, men are the same way. We've seen they will not behave themselves if they're left to themselves. And they say, but the Lord, Jesus Christ is the one who, around whom we can center our hopes for any kind of peace and cooperation here. That's all. We can't do it ourselves. We cannot any more than dogs will behave. Just statistical probability or anything else, they will not behave. And they'll start. And once it fight, it will become pandemonium. All the dogs will get into it. And it's happened again and again in the world, and it's happening today. So these are very wise verses here, the 27th. Thus we may see that the Lord is merciful to all who will, in sincerity of hearts, call upon his holy name. You don't trust in yourself. You see, you must call upon his name, because you don't have the wisdom to carry it off. And it's the gate of heaven is open unto all who will believe on Jesus Christ. It's perfectly open to anyone. Thus we see that whosoever, notice it's talking about individuals, no matter how the world goes, the individual can be happy here. That whoever will may lay hold upon the word of God, which is quick and powerful, which shall divide asunder all the cunning and snares that surround us. Everything is deception with us as far as we're concerned. Trauma and Laban, this sort of thing. Cunning and snares and wiles of the devil, and lead the man of Christ straight on the narrow course. You can go through it all and won't be affected. And then you would even notice here, there is nothing under our feet in our society. We have no solid ground. We're just going on from day to day, like the stock market. We're just carrying on and living, I say, from one day to the next. That's what you do. Say there's nothing under our feet, as Shakespeare says. Or in the even. To be imprisoned in the viewless winds and born with restless violence round about the pendant earth. The earth is pendant, it just hangs there. We're born in restless violence and we have no place to put our foot. We have no security, no solidity, nothing you can rely on, except we rely on the darndest things, and when the market cracks, then what happens, you see? But notice the cunning and the snares that lead us to the straight and narrow across the everlasting gulf. This isn't just rhetoric he's pulling off at all. It's a very strict instruction of the our situation. A gulf of misery which is prepared to engulf the wicked and land their souls on the other side. To sit down, notice, sit down with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, with their holy fathers, and go out no more. See, that's solid security. To sit down and never have to go out again, you see. This is a very vivid imagery here. This is what atonement is. Home at last, at one. Be one, united with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's what the gospel is for. And so they could have continual rejoicing with this assurance in Zarahemla. Well, how can you rejoice continually? Don't you get worn out? No. I'm told from many reliable sources that the pioneers rejoiced continually. They were happy all the time. In their worst sufferings and so forth, they said, we just celebrated. We just thought it was a picnic. We were like people that had just been let out of jail. Sure, we had hard work and so forth, but it was fun. Well, it is possible to be that way, but we certainly have forgotten a few lessons, haven't we?